So, just to introduce myself, I'm John Stuart Reed. I'm an acoustic physics researcher. I've been studying sound since I was in my early 20s, and I'm now 67, so you can see that it's in my blood. I've studied a lot of different aspects of sound. But the aspect of sound that we're going to be talking about this evening is sound healing. And what I'm going to be sharing, and Annalisa's going to be sharing, are aspects of sound in relation to healing. I had an amazing healing experience that I'm going to be sharing. I'm also going to be getting into the technicalities of how does sound heal? How does it really heal? So there's a little bit of science involved. I hope you'll bear with me on the science. Annalisa's going to be sharing with you her wonderful spiritual experiences. Annalise has studied spirituality for many, many years, 30 years or more. Never mind, she says how many years. She's been studying spirituality of all different aspects, and also spiritual healing and energy healing. And she's going to be sharing her experiences in terms of belief and how intention amplifies all forms of healing. So we'll get into that a little bit later. But to begin with, before I really begin the talk properly, I'd like to share with you something which no one has seen in the world. So you are going to be the first people ever to see this. And what it is, we have had a project for the last 12 months to make visible the sounds of, or the soundtrack of, Clair de Lune, the wonderful Debussy piece of music. Now, Clair de Lune means light of the moon. It's a beautiful piece of music. I'm sure most of you will know it. This is the first time that Clair de Lune or any classical music has been made visible using the instrument that we're going to be showing you a little bit later, the cymoscope instrument that makes sound visible. You've just seen some visible sound that Lynn Clair showed there. This is the sound of Clair de Lune made visible. To do it, we took all the notes of Clair de Lune, played by a beautiful concert pianist called Daniel Levy, and we took all the notes and we made them individually visible on the cymoscope, and then my son, who's a wonderful video editor, put them all together in a video exactly in synchronous with the soundtrack. So this is what you're going to be seeing right now, for the first time anywhere in the world. It happened here.
Thank you.
So this talk is about sound healing at the cellular level. But before we get to actually talking about what happens or what we believe happens at the cellular level, I'd like to give you an introduction to various things that happened that brought me to this particular point in my life and also in my beliefs concerning sound healing. Let's begin at the beginning, and I'm talking about the beginning of time, the beginning of the universe. And some of you probably know that right at the very beginning of time, according to all the theories of modern cosmology, there was a Big Bang. Now, whether this is true or not, we don't really know for sure, of course, but there's evidence, there's strong evidence, that it really did happen, that there was this Big Bang. And according to the current cosmological theories, the bang lasted intensely for about 1 million years. What I mean by the bang, I'm talking about the sound of the bang. Not talking about the expansion of the universe, I'm talking about the sound that was present in that early universe. According to the theories, within the first 1 million years, the sound was so intense that it was far greater in terms of its organizational ability than gravity or any of the other forces that existed in the early universe. So therefore, sound was a formative force in the early universe. So it actually helped to structure the universe that we see today. So when you look up into the sky through a powerful telescope, you see groups of galaxies here, clusters of galaxies here, then a huge space, then a cluster of galaxies here, and then so on. Big clusters all over the universe. Why are these clusters where they are? According to the present cosmological theories, the reason is because sound caused these clusters of matter in certain areas of the sky, of space. And so, we're starting right at the beginning of the universe. Sound causes structure, always does. And so I'm going to show you now something which kind of illustrates this pretty well. I wish we had a cymer plate here to show you, but this is actually a very quick demonstration of what a cymer plate does. Now let me just very quickly tell you before you see it what's going to happen. This is a metal plate. You sprinkle sand on the metal plate and you play the metal plate with a violin bow. Have any of you actually seen this done in real time in front of your eyes?
There was a demonstration yesterday here.
No, but this is a manual cymer plate. This is not driven with an electromechanical. This is just a plate of metal and a violin bow. No magic other than that. So let's show you what happens when you sprinkle sand on this plate and then you add sound. You see, just adding sound causes this beautiful pattern to form on the plate. And you can, it doesn't matter where you play the plate, you will get a different pattern forming. So that shows basically that the power of sound creates form from formlessness. Now the fact that you can't see what's happening because sound is invisible makes it a little bit difficult. But now that you've seen that sound does create form, it will help you, I think, in your sound healing practices to know that every sound that you make creates sound at the cellular level and in fact all around you. But we get into that a little bit later. Now, the next premise that we're talking about was sound the trigger for life? And this is an important, very important aspect of sound. No one really knows how life formed in the primordial oceans. There's lots of theories about it, but nobody actually knows for sure. Some of you may have followed the recent wonderful science of Comet 67P. Comet 67P is a comet that was followed by the European Space Agency. Have any of you been following it, following the news? Nobody has followed the news. This is an amazing thing. A comet has been followed for several years by a spacecraft. It's so audacious, they landed the spacecraft on the comet as it was traveling around the sun. Can you believe it? It's amazing, but it happened. And the main reason they sent the spacecraft to the comet was to find out if there were any organic compounds on the comet. And they did find organic compounds on the comet. And the reason they were doing this is because one of the theories concerning how life formed in the primordial oceans is that comets seeded the oceans with organic compounds. And now that they found actual organic compounds on this comet, it kind of all supports the theory. I'm mentioning that because there has to be a way that life formed in the primordial oceans. There has to be a mechanism. And if you have the building blocks of life already in the primordial oceans brought by comets, then obviously you've got a start, haven't you? You've got a start. But look, watch this. In our laboratory, we, with the cymoscope, have seen many, many patterns that resemble early life forms. So here you see on the right-hand side a trilobite. On the left-hand side, that blue image is actually a pattern in the water of the cymoscope that looks like a trilobite. Now, if that happened only once, you might say, oh, well, it's just a coincidence. But look at this. There's a starfish on the right, and on the left you see what looks like a starfish, but it's actually a sound pattern on the cymoscope. On the right, you see a diatom of another very early organism in the oceans. On the left, you see what looks like a diatom, but it's actually an image taken in our laboratory again. And we have many, many examples of this. Now, how many times have we got to do this before somebody conks us on the side of the head and says, hello, was sound involved in the creation of life? Well, I for one believe that it was. And yes, exactly. Someone said, like the Bible, in the beginning was the Word. So this is the question. If sound triggered life, shouldn't sound be able to heal life? Well, of course it does. But it's a very important part of the puzzle. Now, some of you, I know, were at the workshop yesterday that Annalise and I ran. And we've already talked a little bit in the workshop about the shape of sound. I'm going to mention it again now very briefly, only because when we talk towards the end of the talk about how sound healing actually works, it's very important to know that sound is not a wave. Everybody talks about sound waves. So when you talk about a sound wave, you get the distinct impression in your mind that the sound is doing this. But sound does not do that. Sound is not a wave. The reason that scientists, physicists, acousticians talk about sound waves is because they're talking about the graph of the sound energy. They're not talking about the shape of the sound. So it gives you a kind of false idea that sound is a wave that's coming out of my mouth now and it's wiggling its way through the air. Of course, it doesn't do that. And here's a graphic to show you that sound is actually a bubble. All audible sounds are bubble-shaped. And so what's coming out of my mouth now, or coming out of these speakers, are sound bubbles. But the sound bubble is not static, of course. It's expanding rapidly. And as it's expanding, it's doing this. It's pulsating in and out. And it's this pulsation that is called the wave. And I think it's it gives people a false impression about what sound, the shape of sound. Sound is definitely spherical or a bubble shape. And what we're showing here is a sound bubble that's been halved. And you can see rings in that bottom half of the bubble like where there are dense colors of blue, and then there are other areas where less dense blue, they are showing you the compression of sound within the bubble, areas of compression and what's called rarefaction, which is the opposite to compression, where the sound pressure is less. I don't want to get into the technicalities, but suffice to say that the graph in the middle, the sine graph, is the graph of the sound. It is not what the sound looks like. So that might be a little bit of a surprise to some of you who were not at the workshop last evening. Sound is not a wave. Please remember this. It's very important when we talk about how sound heals. There is a sound bubble being formed around a violin as the violinist plays her instrument. Then you will see that beautiful bubble forming. Of course, it's not static. It's expanding rapidly away from her. What we've done is, in a sense, taken a photograph at a moment in time to show what the sound would look like. Can you imagine if we could actually see sound, we would be surrounded by this beautiful kaleidoscopic world in which bubbles are everywhere, and on the surface of the bubbles are beautiful patterns. Imagine that. Well, the Cymoscope instrument is actually already able to show us what sound looks like, and we're even getting to the stage where we will be able to make sound visible in three dimensions. In 1997, I had the privilege of being inside the Great Pyramid of Egypt to do some experiments. So these were acoustics experiments that I wanted to perform, and I got special permission to perform these experiments. And one of the experiments I wanted to perform was to discover what the resonances look like in the granite box that is called a sarcophagus in the King's Chamber. Now, those of you who know what the sarcophagus is, it's a 3.7 ton block of granite that's been hollowed out, and supposedly the pharaoh, when he died, was put in the sarcophagus. I don't actually believe that, and a lot of other people don't believe it either, but nevertheless, that is the accepted Egyptological explanation for why the sarcophagus is there. In my case, I was there with my father earlier, the year before, and I lay in the sarcophagus and I made a glissando. Those of you who came to the workshop will know that the glissando can be very useful. When you make a glissando, if you do that in your bathroom at home, for example, you will always hear one sound, one note that is much, much louder than any other, and that is the resonant frequency of your bathroom. Now, isn't that interesting? Wow. Not really. But in this case, I did the glissando lying in the sarcophagus. This was the year before, in 96. And when I did that, one particular frequency was not only much louder than any other, but also every single cell in my body tingled. It was amazing. What an amazing experience. And that was what led me to then go on and decide to do the actual experiments in the Great Pyramid. But what I'd like to share very briefly with you is two things about this. In 1997, when I went to the pyramid to do the experiments, I had a severely injured back. This is the relevant part of what I'm sharing. My back was in so much pain that I thought I would have to cancel the whole mission to Egypt. I didn't think I could do it. So I took a lot of painkillers, and I kind of literally crawled into the pyramid on my hands and knees in great pain, and I set up the experiment. And the experiment was to see if I could look at the resonances in this box, to discover why was this box so amazing? Why did I feel all my cells tingle in that amazing way? So what I did was I stretched a membrane across the top of the sarcophagus all the way around with little bags of sand to give it tension. And then I sprinkled sand on the membrane, and then I excited the sarcophagus with a loudspeaker. And I had an oscillator, a mechanical way or electronic way of creating sounds, sound tones. And I turned the oscillator through various settings. What happened? Two things happened. First of all, I started to see hieroglyphs coming out on the surface of the membrane. Now, you would think that's impossible. I started to see hieroglyphs coming out on the sarcophagus, and the antiquities inspector who was with me ran over and he said, "How you do that? How you do that?" I said, "I don't know, it's just happening." And he said, "Well, what can I do? Can I help you? You know," because before this he'd been very bored and he thought this crazy Englishman is doing some crazy things. But now he got very interested, and I don't want to, you know, go to labor this point. It's not really part of the talk in terms of, you know, the cymatics. Yes, these are cymatic patterns and they look like hieroglyphs. But I don't want to get into all of that now, because we really want to stay focused on sound healing. What I'd like to say is that what happened for me, about 20 minutes into these experiments, all the pain in my back left me, completely gone.
Wow.
Now, I thought at that time, I know the reason why the pain has gone. I'm so excited because I saw all these amazing hieroglyphs. My body is full of endorphins. I'm obviously on a high, and that's why the pain has gone. And when I get outside the pyramid, it's going to come back and I'm going to be in agony again. Well, I can tell you it never ever came back. The pain never came back. I was able to lift the equipment out of the pyramid myself. Before that, everyone had brought the equipment in. So the pain never came back. And when I got back home, I'm thinking to myself, hang on a second, what happened here? I saw hieroglyphs come out on the sarcophagus. That was amazing. But also my back was healed, permanently healed. How could this be? Something amazing clearly was happening. And that was what set me on to the journey, not only to think cymatics, which is the science of making sound visible, is a potentially wonderful tool. If we can make hieroglyphs visible on an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus, there must be ways to use this technology in other ways. And maybe it can be connected with sound healing. How did my back get healed with sound? I had no idea. So that's quite a long time ago. It's taken me all these years to discover what I think is the mechanism. Anyway, here is the cymoscope instrument. You see it shot here in our laboratory. I mean, it doesn't look a lot, but believe me, this small instrument can do amazing things. So it's controlling the way that sound is put into water. Effectively, you are imprinting the sound vibrations onto water and therefore making them visible. So if I can put it in simple terms, sound is a periodic phenomenon, right? It's a vibration, it's periodic. What we do with the cymoscope is we are transcribing, the word would be transcribing, the periodicities of sound, and we're transcribing into the periodicities of water. So we're now creating waves, and I do mean waves this time. So we make little wavelets on the surface of the water from the periodicities of the sound. So the sound bubble now really does become a sound wave, in a sense. We're making the sound visible in this way. So this is where we've come to after all these years. We've come to the point of having an instrument that can actually make sound visible. But we're also now at a point just before we launch a cymoscope app. So now we have a cymoscope instrument available, but we also have a cymoscope app. And this has not been launched in the world yet. It's complete, and we are ready to launch it. And I'd like to show you it now very, very quickly. This is an iPad, of course, and some of you will be able to see this, probably some of you may not, but you can see that there is there a piano keyboard which is circular. And if I press a key here, maybe I should turn the volume up. Hang on a second. Okay, I've turned the volume up. on the other side of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Can some of you see that? Yeah, you can. There's a whole lot you can do with this little app. This particular set of notes are in monochrome, but you can change it to color. You can press this button here, and you can sing to it, and it will change according to your own voice. So you can do lots of different things with this app. I just wanted to mention it very briefly that this is going to be launched in about a month's time. So, thank you. It's not really a plug to sell anything, it's just to say, to tell you that it is an amazing thing that's been created here. And we actually, the other thing that we're going to be developing to go with this app, which will help profoundly deaf children, is a vibration pad, so the children will be able to play the app with one finger, and with their other hand, they will be able to put their fingertips onto a vibration pad and feel the music through their fingertips. So if you're a profoundly deaf child or even an adult, it will be a great asset for children or adults who have never heard music before, because now they're going to be experiencing music in a completely different way, feeling it through their fingertips and seeing it on the cymoscope, which I think will be a wonderful thing for the world. Now, I'd like to show you one or two little videos before we get into the technicalities of sound healing. This first video just have to move this out of the way if I can. I think I might have crushed it. I've crushed my PowerPoint. Oh dear. Never mind. We'll start it again in a minute. I want to show you these videos here first of all. So what happened here is a human heart, a stethoscope was placed on the heart, and the sound was recorded. And then the sound was put into the cymoscope. The amazing thing about this is that one particular frame, and there's only one frame in that whole movie, actually very strongly resembles the Merion frequency. You know that video that you saw earlier? Very strongly resembles that. It's as if to say that the Merion frequencies are literally embedded in our heart. The reason I wanted to show you that video is because it's showing you that the cymoscope instrument is a tool that can allow all sorts of different aspects of the world to be brought into a visual focus. If you can see something, you can understand it at a far deeper level, usually. So, and the reason for this, I think, is because our visual acuity is so powerful compared with other aspects of our brain that we can understand the world and the universe, and of course in this case biology, far better. Imagine the world of medicine, for example, without the microscope. Imagine that. So it's this ability to see things, see the dynamics of a process that allow us to understand the process at a very deep level. And so we know someone who we've lost contact with, unfortunately, but he is a Turkish doctor who believes that the cymoscope will one day be able to help cardiologists to be able to predict heart diseases even before they can be identified by other means. So that would be a wonderful day for medicine, wouldn't it? I'd like to, some of you last evening, we mentioned the work of James Jimczewski, who is a scientist at UCLA in California. And James Jimczewski has invented a new science called sonocytology. And sonocytology is the science of making the sounds of cells audible. And the way he does that is with a special type of device called an atomic force microscope. Now, why is it important to be able to listen to the sounds of cells? Well, because from that technology comes the potential to eradicate diseases in the body in a wonderful new way. Instead of giving people drugs, which completely mess up our systems, this new technology one day will be able to eradicate all sorts of diseases in the body without any kind of invasion in the sense of drugs. So to give you an example, I mentioned this briefly last evening, if you had a tumor, you might be able to go to a doctor one day where he said, oh, I see you've got a lump in your belly or whatever. Let me take a biopsy of it. He takes a biopsy, puts it in a box, presses a few buttons, and says, oh, you've got a such and such sound tumor. In other words, he knows the sound of that tumor and he has identified the sound of the tumor. What does he do? He then amplifies that sound, puts it into a probe, puts the probe on your belly, and starts to melt the tumor. Why would the tumor melt? Because the sound that you're putting back into the tumor is the same sound that the tumor makes at the cellular level. And when you put a sound into a cell, which is the same sound that the cell makes itself, then resonance occurs. The cell likes that sound, and if you put too much sound in of the same sound that the cell makes, what happens is the cell starts to implode, starts to melt. And so this is the future, this is the potential future, where we'll be able to eradicate diseases simply by listening to the sounds of cells. So I'd like to show you this quick video now of the sound of a cell made visible on the cymoscope. So we didn't make the sound file. This sound file was made by Professor James Jimczewski. And what we've done is to make it visible. Something, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's the sound of a living cell, one particular type of cell. Someone has a question here. So the lady's asking, that is this the case that you play the same sound? Yes, the theory, the physics of it is, if you put the same sound into the cell that the cell likes, that the cell makes itself, but if you increase the amplitude greatly, then the cell will absorb the energy to a point where it cannot absorb any more, and then the cell will implode, then the cell will disappear, basically it will dissolve. Now, you could not get rid of a tumor instantly. It would take time, and of course, as the tumor is melting, so there would be toxicity in the body. The body has to have time to mop up all that, all the dead material. So you'd have to do it over a period of days, maybe even weeks, depending on the size of the tumor. But one day it will be possible to eradicate tumors, or it's looking that technology is coming, which is an exciting day. Instead of having to use drugs, right? A cymoscope in your pocket. Wonderful day. Children are going to love it as well. The heart sound. Okay, I'm just going to take you very briefly back to, before we get into the technical stuff, back to ancient Egypt, because it should be mentioned that the Egyptians were themselves experimenting with sound. I think many of you know that Pythagoras has been accredited with inventing the whole concept of music therapy, which of course is a wonderful therapy today to alleviate depression and all other forms of mental illness. So music therapy that began with Pythagoras, but where did Pythagoras get his ideas from? Well, when you read about Pythagoras, you know that he actually traveled in Egypt. And so many people have speculated that maybe Pythagoras got his ideas about music therapy from the ancient Egyptians. And knowing what I know now about the ancient Egyptians in terms of their use of sound, I believe that is entirely likely that Pythagoras got his all of his intelligence, or at least some of it, from the ancient Egyptians. And I'm mentioning here there is a photograph of a Dendera sanatorium. How many of you knew that the Egyptians actually had hospitals? Nobody's owning up to it. Anyway, they did. And here's the one from a place called Dendera, which is a wonderful temple. But outside the temple is this hospital, or called a sanatorium. And they had them all over Egypt. So it's entirely possible that they were using sound therapies in their sanatoriums in the days when Pythagoras visited there, about 500 BC. There's Pythagoras. And I also would like to mention very briefly that the Aboriginals in Australia have been using sound healing with their didgeridoo, or the proper name is Yidaki instrument. Some people say for 40,000 years they've been using that Aboriginal instrument, that Yidaki or that didgeridoo, to heal broken bones, soft tissue injuries. And it just so happens that a lot of the work that's been done on sound healing in recent years is showing that all of the frequencies that are needed to heal broken bones and soft tissue injuries are present in the Yidaki. So there's been scientific validation to show that what the Aboriginals have been doing for perhaps 40,000 years is now coming into the modern era. What was that question? Well, some people are saying 40,000 years ago. It may not have been that far back, but it's certainly a long time. Many, many thousands of years, the Aboriginals have been doing this kind of work. I mentioned that lots of work has been done to show, to provide the frequency, to identify the frequencies at which sound heals broken bones and sound heals soft tissues. And here was one piece of research that was done in relation to little cats. You know, when a cat injures itself, it purrs. It purrs, 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 purrs. Why is this? Why does an animal that's had an injury make sound? And of course, the answer is, it makes sound to heal itself. The scientists who recognized the fact that cats purred when they're injured asked the question, why would an animal make a sound when it's trying to heal itself? You would think that it would actually want to conserve its energy. But no, the cat actually uses energy. But it's using energy to create sound, and the sound actually accelerates the healing of the injuries that the cat has. If it's fallen from a high place and it's got, you know, all sorts of internal injuries, the cat can purr and purr and purr for several days until it's healed. So there's another example in nature, but now science has actually identified the various frequencies at which the cat is healing itself. I'm also going to mention very briefly that there are already therapeutic modalities using sound in hospitals, in sports injury clinics, where they're not using audible sound, they're using ultrasound, which is high frequency sound. High frequency sound in the case of what I'm talking about now in hospitals is about 1 million hertz. That's very, very high frequency sound. But ultrasound actually starts at about 50,000 hertz, 50,000 up to as high as you want to go. But the point is here, that here we have a situation where hospitals and clinics are using sound, in this case very high frequency sound, to cause healing. Let's say you have a broken bone, and let's say you have a plaster cast put on that bone, and it's starting to heal, but then you do something very silly. You disturb the fracture while it's healing. You do something that you shouldn't be doing. What happens is that the body now will not heal that fracture. It refuses to heal. If you bring ultrasound in to that fracture area, the fracture will start to heal again. That's just one of many, many examples of how ultrasound is used in a medical, in a hospital or in a sports injury clinic. But the amazing thing about this is that the medical community does not know how ultrasound heals. They have no idea. It just does. And the strange thing about this is that in the medical world, you don't need to know. Isn't that amazing? You don't need to know how it works. If it works and it doesn't have any side effects, great, let's use it, guys. But that's the point I'm making here, that they don't know how it works, but I'm just about to get into how it might work. How does sound healing work? How does sound healing work? This is the interesting part of the talk. If you didn't find the rest interesting. This first slide here, I mentioned it very briefly last night. I just thought I'd put it in here to show you that resonance plays a very important part in sound healing. A whole person resonates at around about 7 to 10 hertz. A heart resonates at about 100 hertz. And a cell, you know that sound that I played earlier, central frequencies about 1,000 hertz. So in other words, as the mass of the object increases, so the frequency goes down. Or conversely, as the mass of the object, in this case a human cell, is a tiny little mass, the frequency goes up. The resonance. This is the ability of the cell to absorb energy. Have any of you heard of the work of Bruce Lipton? Quite a lot of you have heard of Bruce Lipton. Bruce Lipton has done some wonderful work. The part of the work I'd like to mention that Bruce Lipton does that gives us a clue as to how sound healing works is in relation to what are called integral membrane proteins. Every cell has a membrane. And from the surface of the membrane are little tiny antennas, little tiny aerials or antennas that are probing out into the environment around the cell. And you see one here on the drawing, and it looks a bit like a tuning fork. Can you see that? But look what Bruce Lipton says. Receptor antennas read vibrational energy fields such as light and sound and vibrate like tuning forks. So think of it. The cell has a membrane. You've got all these little tuning fork devices that are probing out into the environment around the cell. And these little devices are the way that the cell communicates with its brothers and its sisters around it, sending information, sharing data all of the time. What happens when a cell has been damaged in some way? It's been injured. A cell can be damaged by an invasion of pathogens, like say some kind of a bacterium, or it can be a virus and it invades the cell, or it could be an injury. You have bruised yourself or you have damaged yourself in some way. It could be any kind of injury, doesn't matter what it is. The cell goes to sleep. It's a state called senescence. It means that the cell is not awake, it's asleep. In other words, it's a bit like when a whole human being goes into a coma. Why do people go into comas? Usually because the body is trying to heal itself from some serious condition. But the same thing happens with an individual cell. If it's damaged in some way, it doesn't matter what the injury is or it doesn't matter what the pathogen is that's invading your body, that part of your body, it might be an organ or some other part of your body, has essentially gone to sleep. Or maybe part of the organ has gone to sleep. Some of the cells have gone to sleep. They're not working the way they're meant to be working. They're sleeping. Why? So that they can try to heal themselves with time. In other words, they're kind of resting, and they're in a resting state, okay? Well, one hypothesis is that the sound caused a pattern on the surface membrane of your cells, and those patterns of energy excite these little tuning forks that are literally protruding out of the cells. And if you get the exact right frequency, the correct frequencies, you will excite more of these little integral membrane proteins, more of these little tuning forks, if you like, and you will wake the cell up. So it's, in a sense, you're sort of feeding the cell, not with food, not with nutrients, but with sound. You're giving it energy in the form of sound, and you are causing it to wake from its senescent state, its sleep state, into a waking state. You're literally waking it up and saying, hey, it's okay, you know, you're going to be well soon, and you can start replicating again. This is the essence of the theory. This first video is the sound of the same, that same video that I showed you of the living cell made visible. We're now showing you the analysis of that sound on an analyzer. That's the sound of the healthy cell. This is the sound of the same cell with a drop of acid on it. What you can see is there that the frequencies that the cell is making, these are the sounds that the cell is actually making, have changed. And can you see they've all gone much higher in frequency than where they were? When you, as sound healers, make sounds to a cell, there's this general theory that is profound around the world at how sound healing works, which is that you are, when a body goes into some form of illness, it's essentially going out of tune, like an orchestra going out of tune, and that what you are doing is to kind of bring it back into tune, okay? And what you can see here is that there's a lot of truth in that. The sound of a cell has a particular sound signature. When you damage that cell in some way, the frequencies that the cell make, in this case, go much higher. And when you play the sounds of the cell back to the cell, it starts to bring the sounds of the cell back into a normal state again. So there's some, a lot of truth in this concept of retuning a sound of a cell to its healthy state after it has been injured. We're showing you the sound on the surface of this little tiny droplet of water. It's so small that it's hard to see it. Isn't that beautiful? You can hardly see it, but it is there. We change the frequency and what happens? The pattern on the surface of the droplet changes. We change the frequency back to the higher frequency, and the pattern goes back to its original form. But here we've got a tiny, tiny little drop of water. It has a membrane, just as a cell has a membrane. And when you make sound to that little drop of water, how does it respond? It responds by creating a beautiful pattern on its surface. And if you change, that is just a pure one single tone, don't forget, that's not a complex sound. If we put a complex sound in, we get a very complex pattern. In this case, it was a single tone, a single frequency, and we got a pattern. So just think about what I've been sharing about the cells. Every cell in your body has this membrane, has the little tuning forks protruding from it, the work of Bruce Lipton. And now we know that sounds create patterns on the surface membranes of cells. We're going to be doing that work in a couple of months' time, but at least you've seen here now that these patterns occur even at this tiny little scale on a droplet of water that you can hardly see. Now, I'm going to show one more video before Annelise begins her talk. And this is a field of water droplets, and I changed the frequency. And I want you to see, I kept the amplitude very low because I wasn't interested in this case of seeing patterns. What I wanted to see was, what size of water droplet does it take to form, to become excited as the frequency changes? So just watch this. The water droplet at the bottom, this big one at the bottom, is the size of a grain of refined table salt. Very, very small droplet. So you can get the idea that the other ones are much, much smaller than that. We're almost at the point of the same size as a living cell. We're almost there. Just watch what happens as the frequency changes. Okay, here we go. Sorry. You see the changing, the different droplets are becoming excited at different frequencies. Now the one on the left, now the one on the top, now the one on the right. You see, as the frequency changes, the different sizes, the different masses of water droplets become excited. And the point about that, it's proving the principles of resonance, okay? Even at this scale, where you've got little droplets of water that are so small you can hardly see them, but they're all responding to different frequencies. Why? Because of the simple principles of resonance. You know, I mentioned about ultrasound in hospitals being used as a healing modality, and no one knows how it works. But here is a natural source of ultrasound. Now, I know Israel is a pretty dry country, so you probably don't have many waterfalls, right? But you do have the sound of the ocean. And so part of this little video that I'd like to end with is showing you, we have an ultrasound meter here. This is the meter you see on the left. It's monitoring the amount of ultrasound that's present. Mother Nature's healing ultrasound. This first part is the waterfall. You see the little dot going over to the right? That's telling you how much ultrasound. Now here's the ocean. The point about that is that ultrasound is available in nature. And this is almost certainly why when you go for a walk by the seashore, you feel so much better, especially if there's some nice waves coming in. The more waves, the more ultrasound, and the more healing effect that you're actually getting from Mother Nature. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So with that, I'm going to close. I'm going to hand you over to Annelise, who will open your minds in a different way. Thank you very much.